David Holmes, Belfast-born DJ, producer and composer, has spent over three decades pushing musical boundaries, pioneering acid house in Northern Ireland during the Troubles, scoring major films like Ocean's 12 and the BAFTA award-winning TV series Killing Eve. Known for his genre-defying sound, long-standing collaborations with directors like Steven Soderbergh and indeed Steve McQueen, Holmes has built a career rooted in innovation and fearless creativity. He will be at the Jameson Connects The Circle Stage at the All Together Now Festival coming up over the bank holiday weekend. But I'm delighted that he joins me this evening from Belfast. I'm guessing and hoping, David, that yes, that's where you are.
I am in my studio in Belfast.
I hope I'm not interrupting a moment of creativity. That is there a piece of music flying around in your head even as I speak?
Well, actually, I was actually just working on... When I first met Sinead O'Connor, it was at Shane McGowan's 60th. And the first thing I said to her was, I just met her. And her first of all, her performance that night completely just hypnotized the audience. It was truly transcendent. And then I met her afterwards. And I always had an idea about working with her. And she was walking my direction. I just stopped her, introduced myself and said, I would love to make a record with you about healing. Mm. And her ears pricked up, and then we exchanged numbers. And over the course of 6 years, we made the record. But what I was actually just working on right now was a version that I recorded of You're the One.
Yeah.
Of course, by the late, great Shane McGowan, written and performed by. And that was the song that Sinead recorded that night, but we never got a chance to actually do it. And but I've done a version with this incredible talent from the north of Ireland called Roisch. I don't know if you've heard of her. It's R-O-I-S. It's Irish for rose, yes, as you surely know.
Yeah.
And she's just a phenomenal talent. I mean, she is, in my opinion, like in terms of possessing real emotion and tonality and nuance and it's the closest thing I've heard to Sinead in terms of just having that sort of that thing that you're either born with that or you're not, you know. And she doesn't sound like Sinead, but her voice has a similar power. I've seen her live and she just completely blew my mind. So we've done this version for the Shanes. There's a tribute album and it's going to be for that.
So well, listen, how I wish that we had a direct lead from your studio into our studio and I'd say, open up that theatre now and we can hear it. I'm really looking forward to hearing that. It sounds like a phenomenal realisation of that song. And funnily enough, we were speaking about Sinead O'Connor on the programme last night, new book of essays that has been recently published, Nothing Compares to You, what Sinead O'Connor means to us, and a group of, I don't know how many it is, 20, 30 people have written essays and attached them to a particular song of Sinead's and the many facets of Sinead and what she meant to lots of these essay writers. What did she mean to you, David?
She meant brutal honesty, integrity. She was the real deal. I remember working with her and look, I was working with Sinead when she was, you know, an older woman, you know, like she wasn't the sort of the, you know, 20-year-old just voice of an angel, but when she sang, she's just still had this incredible power. And I remember her saying, you know, I'll never be able to give you there's a technically better version of that performance, but I could never match that emotion. Mm. So it was all about being real in that moment and what it takes for someone like her to actually get her lyrics out.
Yeah.
So I think there was something caught there that is really precious because, you know, she still, her voice still has an incredible power.
Yeah.
But, you know, you know she's not, you know, Sinead O'Connor from yesteryear, but it still is like, oh my God. It's like I'm sitting, used to pinch myself sitting in the studio.
Yeah.
Just going, this is my Nina Simone moment, you know?
Yeah, and it's an emotional honesty as you talk about. And ironically, I was going to finish up our conversation by talking about Sinead O'Connor, but since we're in there, we might as well stay there. Because it obviously we're approaching the second anniversary of her death this Saturday, in fact. You were working with her on an album at the time of that sudden death, and one of the tracks I think that was there was Trouble of the World. Tell us a little bit about this. I think there's a good story around how she just wasn't happy with a performance until she got the one that you got, I think maybe the second or third time, maybe more than that, that you went at it.
Well, that we actually did that independently off the album. That was for the time of Black Lives Matter.
Oh, right, yeah.
The murder of George Floyd, and you know the rising up throughout the whole world at that moment, and she, you know, she wore her heart on her sleeve,
yeah,
and she really deeply emotionally felt what was happening in the world, you know, and so she says, "I want to do a cover of this." And we devised a plan, and we shared ideas about the music and the tempo and stuff like that. And so I was left to go and do the instrumental and work out an arrangement. So after that was done, I played her that, and she listened to it and says, "Okay, I'm coming up on Tuesday," and I was up on the Monday night. No, she was coming Tuesday. She came up, did the vocal, and it she just couldn't quite nail it. Mm. And you know, they were her words. Do you know what I mean? It was like she didn't need a producer to sort of tell her if something was good or not. You know, she knew herself. She was her own critic. You know, and so. She says, "Look, I'll come back on Thursday." So we recorded a couple of tracks that day, and then I was kind of working through the night on the Monday. I thought she would have been coming up to my house at, like, I don't know, maybe in the afternoon, because she had the drive up from Bray. But I went to bed, I think it was about 5 a.m. And then the next minute, it's like I just closed my eyes and the doorbell went and I looked at Lise. She says, I'll get it. It's 9 a.m. And I just thought, I beg you any money that she needs.
Lise, of course, is your wife that you're mentioning there. You look at who's that at the door at this time of the morning?
Exactly. And, you know, in the world of music, that's super early.
In lots of worlds, I think it's super early, David, to be fair.
That's one of the reasons why we do this job, let's be honest.
Yeah.
You get to lie in bed until midday. So then I get up. And I went downstairs, and she says, "I'm ready." Like, I literally made a coffee, you know, I jumped in the shower, went in, hit record, and what you hear on the signal was on the single that came out.
So this is what, a 9:30 or 10 o'clock in the morning?
This is 9:30 in the morning, and Jeepers. Then at 10 o'clock, by 10 o'clock, we were downstairs in my kitchen. I made her a bacon sandwich and a cup of tea, and she got in her car and drove back to Bray.
Wow. Let's listen to what she... This is what Sinead O'Connor... still can't get over that. That it was, let's say, for the sake of argument, we'll say 10 o'clock in the morning. I don't care. Any time before midday, any time before evening
time.
No, but
here's the thing. That there was a bit of information that I forgot to tell you. She actually told me that she'd been sitting in the driveway since 7.
Jeepers. So she had the manners to wait.
Well, no, she told me she woke up at about 2 or 3, and she was so excited about recording the vocal, she just got into the car and drove up to Belfast.
Wow.
And then at 9 o'clock, she must have thought, okay, 9's a good time to sort of ring the doorbell. Yeah, but you know what? It's an experience. I mean, that was an experience that I will take to my grave.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You hear the performance in that, it's real. It's like 100% real. There's no auto tune on it.
Nothing.
There's no like compression. You know, it's she is, you know, our own human compressor. I mean, she hated compression. Because she built in her own dynamics about how close or back she was from the microphone and how she could control that. That was my.
That's your experience. Let's
that
have a listen.
Billie Holiday, or my Nina Simone moment.
Yeah, I love it, and I love that. What two wonderful comparisons to make to Sinead O'Connor, Billie Holiday, or indeed Nina Simone. Let's have a listen to a little bit of "Trouble of the World." That is quite an extraordinary opening 1 minute of or thereabouts of Trouble of the World with Sinead O'Connor and producer David Holmes with me on the line from Belfast this morning. Amazing, David, that she could produce that sound, as you say, at 10 o'clock in the morning.
I was like, stop me in my tracks.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah. You know what I mean? And I'm sitting going, oh my God, like talking about waking up. But I was very, very conscious of the moment.
Yeah.
Just because of the way I think about music and my own sort of past history and my love of it and respect for the process. And those moments, they don't come along very often in your life. And then when they do, you kind of like, you know, you just, it's kind of like an emotional reaction.
Yeah.
And, but that's why music is so amazing. You know, it's invisible, you know, you can't hold it, you can't touch it, but it makes you feel so many things. But that was a highlight for sure.
I can imagine. Even as I say, like it was killing me to bring it down as I had to. But I do want to talk to you about other stuff as well. But that is an incredible story, and thanks for sharing it with us. That aspect of that quality of music and that value that music has within your life, both creatively, I would argue from what you're saying, almost spiritually and philosophically as well, it seems to have a very firm place in the very centre of your life. Do we put that all down to your ma, or a fair bit of it down to your ma, and the kind of music that she brought home to you from Chicago where your brother was?
Yeah, but I mean, for sure. I mean, she was, you know, the queen. You know, I mean, she was like, listen, you know, that woman was extraordinary. You know, she was just, you know, I learned so much from her. But I had 9 brothers and sisters, and, you know, I was the youngest, so I inherited so much music. Like I've often said, that, you know, the Sex Pistols were my One Direction. Because I grew up in this environment where I was surrounded by teenagers, and a lot of them were like into music and they were into punk and stuff. So, my sister Maggie, who was probably the most influential out of all my family, she was the eldest. She was like a member of the Beatles fan club, seen them play twice live, you know, went this art college, moved to London in 1969, you know, so she was doing the whole music. I mean, she went at Brian Jones's wake. She's seen the Sex Pistols. She's seen the Clash. She did the whole new wave sort of punk thing, you know, brilliant record collection, which I inherited when she passed away. All of that. But also, I think, like you probably might have guessed, well, it doesn't matter. But, you know, just...
It does matter. Don't stop yourself, please.
No, but, you know, we're all on some kind of spectrum, you know? And mine is definitely sort of ADHD, sort of OCD, you know? It's kind of like, for me, it's a positive force, and I try to use it in a positive way.
Yeah.
But I think growing up in Belfast Look, I always say that it is a privilege to be loved, you know, forget, you know, like money and cars and big houses and all that. If you're with a family who love you, then it's the greatest gift in the world. So
is that what brought
like 9 to 10 kids in a 3-bedroom house in a mostly Protestant loyalist neighborhood it was like 2080, you know, we had a band hall on our street. And for our parents to sort of raise us
you
in a way.
You were Catholics.
Yeah, well, 10 kids, are you kidding me?
I suppose that kind of gives it
when
away.
When was the last time you heard of any other religion having like sort of more than 10 kids? But but you know, they brought us up not to sort of like, you know, judge anyone by the color of their skin or their sexuality. My mother was like, she was incredibly modern in her thinking for someone who was born in 1924. Wow. And you know, I think by the time I was born, she had already raised 9 kids, and she just went, son, just do whatever makes you happy.
I was going to say, I bet you were spoiled. You were the youngest boy. Of course you were spoiled.
Yeah, but then it's just, but to tell you, not, you know, my parents had to sort of work 2 or 3 jobs each.
Yeah.
To sort of, you know, to provide for the family, pay the mortgage and all that. But, you know, there was so much fun and laughter and love in our house, even though, you know, our house was bombed, you know, when I was 4. We had a Jellygnite bomb thrown into our house.
Yeah.
You know.
And I mentioned your brother being in Chicago. That was because he was basically told by a loyalist paramilitary group, get out now. So off he went. Or if he didn't get out.
Well, actually, a member of a loyalist paramilitary group told my dad to get my brother out because he knew we weren't, none of the boys were involved or anything, yeah. You know. He knew we weren't sort of IRA like active or anything, but he had obviously got the word that he was going to get whacked, which happened to so many people. Yeah. Happened to his best friend in 1972 at the corner of our street. And then my dad just said, right, you're going to live in Chicago, like literally. Yeah. And he went, okay. And he drove him down the Conway Street. He drove him down to Dublin Airport, I think it was. It might even been, what do you call the airport? South of Ireland.
Well, I suppose it would have been Dublin. Or I can't imagine where else it would have been other than Dublin Airport at that point in time. Maybe down to Shannon, possibly down to Shannon, was it?
It might have been Shannon.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then he lived there for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
And he's not with us anymore as well. So they Maggie and Michael were
the eldest,
yeah.
You mentioned that importance of love, and clearly from the way you speak about your family, and you mentioned even Lise, your wife there, you've moved back to Belfast from LA, but I'm wondering to what extent.
Oh, that was, I haven't been in LA since 2011.
Is that long? It's 14 years
yeah,
back?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We went there because my daughter was like, what, 7 at the time?
Yeah.
And my wife worked at the BBC and she was offered an opportunity to sort of like take a year out, but with no pay. And I had a couple of movies back to back. And I says, you know what? Why don't we go to live in LA for a year and we can put Nina into college? And because I was working on films, everything was paid for and stuff. And we did that and we ended up staying for 18 months.
Oh, and then, so it was a short stay. Yeah.
Yeah. And then my wife just said to me one day, would you live here if the weather was crap? And I went, absolutely not. And she says, well, I don't think that's a good enough reason to live somewhere.
Yeah.
And our daughter was starting to get an American accent, and that was scary.
That was scarier than the potential weather of Belfast.
Right, we're going back to Belfast.
But I wonder to what extent, you know, and the way you spoke about Sinead O'Connor in that moment, in the before the recording of Trouble of the World. That sounds smolchy now, but anyway, I'll risk it. To what extent is the family that you find within music one that is unified by love? It might be love of the music, it might be love of whatever particular artistic endeavor you're involved in. To what extent has that driven your creativity?
I think music has the power to make you a better human being. Do you know what I mean? There is so much empathy and soul and love in music, and that can come in all shapes and sizes in any genre that you can choose. So, I mean, a music really affects me on a very emotional level. So, you know, my antennas are always up, you know, and sometimes music can change your mind about things. But it's got to be real.
Yeah.
And it's got to be, you know, and you know when it is and you know when it isn't. And it's kind of like, as the saying goes, a blind man on a galloping horse. could tell you when something isn't real and what is. You know, it's kind of at its very essence, you know, love just oozes out of music. And in a world that's so fractured, you know, if you listen to Trouble of the World, I mean, that song had such a powerful meaning at the time. And if you see the video, it's on YouTube. Anyone's listening and want to see the video, it's made by Don Letts. It's an amazing video.
Yeah.
And that song has even more power right at this moment.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to finish up with, because I can't talk to you without talking about your collaborations and work with Steven Soderbergh, because that, I suppose, is you've always spoken about how important that has been in your life and how important those collaborations were. Talk us into, if you would, David, Yen and the Carousel, which is part of Ocean's 12, I think, wasn't it?
Yes. That was inspired by a song that ripped off Taxman by the Beatles.
Maggie told you that, did she?
So it was inspired by a track that already had taken huge artistic license from a track that is iconic. Yeah. And I was kind of ripping off the track that ripped off something else. Not really. It was heavily influenced.
Heavily influenced is a much better term. Well, of course, you're only talking about yourself, so it's not bad if you talk about ripping off.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, let's be honest. You know, it's kind of music. There's no such thing as originality for a start, and I think where you get these original kind of vibrations in music, it's through cross-pollination. It's when you put blues with hip-hop, or you put sort of funk with punk, you know, when you put sort of classical music with really avant-garde kind of drum programming, you know, it's kind of just all these cross-pollination. And but in terms of what original is, I don't think that truly exists. You know,
you've done a bit of it yourself, David. Let's be honest. even if you call it ripping off, Yen and a Carousel sounds pretty original.
I'm the biggest thief that you can imagine.
Listen, it's been great speaking to you, and to use your term, it certainly has been real, David. Thanks a million.
Say one thing before you go? I have never been so prouder to be Irish in the face of their stand against what is happening in Palestine.
Well,
never been prouder.
Right. Well, listen, thanks for your time this evening, David. Really appreciate that. And
thanks so much.
We'll finish up with Yen on a Carousel. Just a little flavour of Yen on a Carousel, the music there from Ocean's 12, as given to us by David Holmes. What a conversationalist he is. David performs, I didn't even get a chance to ask him what sort of stuff he's doing, but I'm sure things like Yen on a Carousel will feature there in the Jemison Connects, the Circle Stage at the Altogether Festival, Altogether Now Festival 2025, taking place from July the 31st through until August the 3rd. Freel Days is a bold idea from Arts Over Borders. Readings from 5 plays by Brian Freel in site-specific locations in the counties where Freel was born and where he lived most of his life. Tyrone, Derry and Donegal being the 3 counties. He was only born in one of them, but he lived in the other 2. Well, but he lived in all 3, in fact, didn't he? That's just this year. They will add to the list of plays each year so that by 2029, 29 Freel plays will be read in locations in the Northwest. The festival kicks off in August this year. 2 of the actors involved join me now. In studio with me here in Dublin is Lorcan Cranach, who will play Hugh in Translations in Unad Cushlucha in Dunluche, and on the line, Evelyn Oyedokun, who takes on the role of Maggie in Dancing at Lunasa, and that will be taking place in St. Columba's Comprehensive School in the Glaunta, also in Donegal, and only yards away, I believe, from the house in which the action of that play, Dancing at Lunasa, would have taken place. But Lorcan, I mean, I suppose any opportunity to get to say the words of Freel is one you're going to grab with both your hands.
It's funny. I was wondering when you were going to how you were going to phrase that question, because I have. It is absolutely true, Sean. If you are given the opportunity to deliver this stuff, you know, no matter where it is, on what, you know what I mean. It's just some of the most beautiful language, and it's some of the most beautifully written plays ever. That, you know what I mean.
Translations. So, I mean, I shared a house once, and in the bathroom, on the back of the door,
there was a
poster of the first production of Translations.
Oh, okay.
And the cast list for that first production. You saw that first
production. I didn't see it. I saw pretty much most of the cast list. It was up in the Guildhall in Derry, and I didn't see it there, but that transferred pretty much intact to the National Theatre in London, which is where I saw it first.
Yes, because Field Day
81, 82 or something like that.
Yeah, Field Day often did that. And that was our first play, but they subsequently often did the plays around Ireland, and then it would transfer to London the following season.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Can you remember in the cast?
Well, Tony Doyle, I played Owen at that stage. Stephen Ray played Manus. Liam Neeson played Dolty. Ray McAnally played Hugh.
Mick Lally was in there, wasn't
Mick
he?
Mick wasn't in it in the one in London. No, and Nuala Hayes was Moira. So it was, you know, quite, and for me, Sean, it was, you know, Translations is, and not just because I'm asked to do this, but Translations is actually one of my top plays of
and
all
Hugh,
time.
And Hugh, the character of the schoolmaster, what a character.
Yeah, it's amazing. Absolutely extraordinary. You're given free rein to be as pompous as you like. How often do we get that chance? And so, I mean, it is one of my, and I remember the first time I saw it, it actually was in the context of being in London as a student. And it's
well, you were studying theatre at that time.
Yeah, I was.
London,
and so I was surrounded by a sort of a particularly British schooling in the theatre. And this came just so fresh into the middle of it all. And it has stayed with me since. And every time I see it, every time I read it, every time, you know, even just recently having read it again, it still sends a shiver up my spine. And I think it's just one of the most beautifully crafted pieces of theatre ever.
Evelyn, you need to put on your headphones there and you'll be able to hear Evelyn Oyedokun, who's joining us from London. You heard, I hope, Evelyn, their Lorcan Cranach's association with the plays of Freel, which goes back quite a bit, as you can hear. What about you?
Yeah.
Obviously, you're not Irish, but what is your association, or what was your first experience of Brian Freel, or is this a very early experience of Freel for you, Evelyn?
This is all new to me. This is my first experience and chance to be part of his work and experience his writing, so I'm really excited.
And of all the plays, for a woman, an actor, a female actor to be involved in, Dancing at Lunacy is the one, the Mundy sisters. You're playing Maggie. How would you describe her within this amazing family that is presented to us on stage in Dancing at Lunacy, Evelyn?
I think she's just so fun, full of life. She's very jokey. She's just a wonderful spirit. Mm. And I'm really excited to share that and bring that on stage. And I'm really excited to be part of the sisterhood.
There were certain plays in Dublin, Lorcan, that were rites of passage for fellas. I think Dancing at Lunacy is probably a kind of a rite of passage for actresses in Ireland.
Yeah, there were lots of lots of rites of passage. You know, not just Freel stuff, but, you know, Roddy Doyle and stuff like that as well. But Lunacy is, you know, obviously the success it's had is testament to how brilliant it is. But what I think is amazing about the connection between these plays is Freel's decision to use a kind of a theatrical mechanism to tell the stories. I mean, the fact that in Translations they can't communicate, but we understand everything they say.
Yeah, they're speaking. They're both speaking different languages, as far as they're concerned. But they're speaking English for us
We are put in a very complicit situation. So we are kind of a privileged situation. And in Lunasa, that amazing moment where the sisters just are taken over by the music that comes out of the radio, and it's actually indescribable. It's an out of body experience, literally.
I remember Patrick Mason, who directed that original production. Talking to he was telling me at one stage about, you know, during rehearsal, he thought, I wonder, is that dance moment happening in the right place in the play? And he suggested to Brian Freed, maybe it's in the and Brian and Patrick has told this story on air, so I'm not telling it stays out of school. And Brian Freed just said, no, I think you'll find it's in the right place. And of course, as Patrick said, he was absolutely right. But it's one of the exciting things about the play, Evelyn, about Dancing at Lunacy, is that wonderful moment. And Maggie is very central to the start of that dance, and I think she is the first of the characters who lifts up the flower out of the bowl and puts it on her face as well, that kind of almost pagan ritualistic thing. Now, these will be rehearsed readings, but there will be an element of staging within it. I guess, have you spoken much about that side of things, or will you wait until you're over and rehearsing for that to be decided upon?
We've spoken about it and how it's definitely going to be a rehearsed reading, but it's going to be more towards the like advanced side rehearsed reading with choreography, and there will be sort of like set choreography and stuff. But we will have the scripts in our hands. But it will be, there'll be props and things, but it will be mainly just us and the words and the audience.
I can't wait to see that dance with scripts
in the hands.
I really just can't.
One hand with the script, the other one putting your hand in the flower and putting it on your face. The other aspect of this whole series of plays and productions, Lorcan, and you've been involved with Arts Over Borders before, I think, the location. You did Faith Healer around a number of...
Yeah.
Did you do it around a number of halls with Faith Healer? Or it's gone around a number of halls this time?
I got brought in very late on in the proceedings, and the way it's set up is that the location is as close or as vital to the play as is possible to be. And indeed, in translations, we're going to be in Dunluí, which is, you know, in the middle of the Gaeltacht.
Yeah.
Because everybody was speaking Oscailge. And so, but with Faith Healer, I remember the first time I went up, what happens is that you travel with the audience to a place, and somewhere in the Bluestack Mountains, which was a small hall, about not much bigger than somebody's living room, which had benches and barely enough room for everybody for the audience to cram into. And up at the other end, there was a small stage, and there was the remains of the last little show that they'd done during the summer, and bits of tinsel from the Christmas panto, whatever like that. And it was absolutely, completely perfect.
Yeah, because for
Frank Hardy's first monologue.
Because Frank Hardy is this travelling faith healer, and he's gone around to little halls just like that. Exactly. So it made total sense.
It sent a shiver up my spine.
I can imagine. And for you, Evelyn, I was saying in the introduction, it is extraordinary that, I mean, this would be close to the house of Brian Friedel's grandparents. In other words, the house where the action of the play actually takes place. I presume you'll go and visit that, and that will bring a certain amount of extra tension or extra information to the performance.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited to be like on the grounds of where everything kind of happened and took place, and sort of like taking that history with it as well. Like, I'm so excited to just to be with everything.
Freel Days, of course, the title of the festival itself, Lorcan, playing around with that Field Day idea. Sean Dorn is at the heart of this.
Sean Dorn is the man behind Arts Over Borders, the initiative. And all of these festivals are his brainchild, really. Mm. And
you had done a Gatto with him, hadn't you?
Bizarrely, this will be my third outing with them, Sean, because earlier in the year we did as part of a Gatto festival or part of a Beckett festival up in Enniskillen, we did a reading of Gatto, which included for the first time. A female rendition of Lucky.
Yeah, Alwyn Ferre, who told us about the adventures on the programme.
Yeah.
And that was a big concession to get from the Beckett estate.
Yeah.
And then yourself and Alwyn in one set, and then two English actors, which was getting this idea of the
Well, it's, and I think this is what part of Sean's brilliance, his cleverness, is that it's always a some kind of an experimental way of presenting the place, which traditionally Gatto, it would have been the reversal of where the more aristocratic would be, would Pozzo and Lucky would be. But in this case...
And you were playing Pozzo.
And I was playing Pozzo. And in this case, that was completely reversed, so that Malcolm Sinclair and Alex Jennings, who were the two English actors, were playing they were playing landed gentry who had actually fallen down, so far down on their luck, that they had nothing left in their lives.
Yeah.
And so... But it was very interesting to hear them saying, you'll have they say, let's go. Well, we can't. Why? Well, we're waiting for Gatto. You know? just fab. Yeah. It was really.
I don't know if you'll be able to get away with that, Evelyn, in terms of dancing at Venus. I don't think you'll be able to. Have you started? And I'm not going to ask you to do it. But have you started thinking about the Donegal accent, started thinking about the way that you'll be approaching that side of things?
I did start thinking about it, but then we also had a conversation and about possibly having a more sort of Caribbean
twist.
Yeah, we haven't done any rehearsals. It's just all in sort of speaking. Mm. But when we all get to the text, it'll be good to play around with what I could possibly do and how it could all come together. Because, I haven't had these. I've never said these words before, and I don't think many, if ever, any black actors, women has played this. These parts,
and the casting is colorblind right across the sisters. Yeah. Well, listen, it does sound like a phenomenal project, and we've only mentioned two of them.
Oh, no.
The translations that Lorcan is involved in.
Going on this.
And very important plays, and each play with a location that will make total sense.
In the case of Volunteers, hasn't been done for 50 years either.
Volunteers, the play, and quite a contentious play in its day, so interesting to be seeing that at this time. Thank you both. Thanks, Lorcan, for being with us, and Evelyn, thanks for joining us on the phone. Lorcan Cranach and Evelyn Oyeduk. Freel Days, a homecoming, runs throughout the month of August. Five different plays. It's in Donegal, it's in Derry, and it's in Tyrone. You can find out full details on the website, which is artsoverborders.com. In books like Kill Your Friends, The Amateurs, and his recent family memoir, Oh Brother, Scottish writer John Niven has explored male struggles in the modern world with fearless honesty and a bit of scabrous wit in the process. His latest book, The Fathers, is both funny and heartbreaking. It charts the unlikely and mutually destructive relationship between two very different Glaswegian men who meet by chance on the night that their sons are born. Delighted to have John Niven join us on the programme this evening. Even chalk and cheese doesn't give us the difference between these two men, Jada and Dan. They are poles apart, really, John, aren't they? The two characters.
Yeah, that's fair to say. They come from very different worlds, but live geographically quite close to each other, which was what kind of appealed to me.
Yeah, and that Glaswegian element, it struck me if Dickens were alive in 2025 and living in Glasgow, this is the type of book he might have written, because it is all about, in many ways, the social inequalities between those two characters, Dan and Jada, and the presumptions that we, even as readers, will make as we're going along.
Yeah, that's very true. It was interesting to me in that Hindland, which is in Glasgow's West End, where Dan, the middle-class, successful fellow, lives, is very close geographically to areas like Partick and White Inch, which are a bit more real, shall we say. Mm. And Jaina comes from that world. But in this country, you know, the great leveller is often the NHS. So they both meet in the front of the maternity ward in the morning that their sons are born. And as you say, they wind up getting involved in each other's lives in unusual ways. But it was important to me that they not be sort of cliches. So as the book unfolds, you begin to get an insight into kind of why Jada is the way he is, how badly parented he was, and the advantages that Dan maybe had in life. Because Dan feels himself creatively a failure. He created this TV show that's a bit like sort of a Taggart type cop drama that your gran probably watches, and he's made a lot of money from it, but he's kind of creatively bankrupt, and he senses he would love to write an important novel, but he hasn't really got anything to write about. And then, of course, over the course of the book, he does get something worth writing about, but it comes at enormous personal cost. You know?
Yeah, I was thinking that, you know, because you have written those novels, you know, the big novels and the memoir, and, you know, bared your soul across all of them. You know, I suppose there must have been a little bit of joy in you saying, well, you know, maybe the fellas that wrote the big television things and made the millions and have a wonderful lifestyle out of that, maybe they're a little bit unhappy at the back of all of that.
Well, if anybody will tell you that spends a lot of their life trying to get sort of books made into films or TV shows made, it's very hard. So, you know, with Dan sort of in this easy life of, you know, making his millions off this hugely successful long-running show, there's maybe a bit of wish fulfilment in my part.
So you do have a long-running series, or something that could be a long-running series, sitting in the drawer at home, and maybe it would see
the... If only I could come up with a target.
Yeah, well, I often think that, you know, if only I knew how to write a blockbuster, I'd write a blockbuster. It's not as easy as it sounds.
I was saying this, and I've just finished my book tour last night in Manchester, actually. And I was saying, your preoccupations kind of are your preoccupations. And as a novelist, minds are kind of men and the way they relate and quite extreme things that they do. I sometimes wish that my preoccupations were, you know, love and romance, like maybe the way Jojo Moyes or David Nichols writes, you know, because it's commercially more of a gore.
the other aspect that I wondered about, the difficulty in the writing of the fathers, was, you know, these are two very different men. Dan, from that wonderful middle class background, loads of privilege, very successful, doesn't really have to worry about too much. It's certainly on the financial side of life. There are other worries that he has, which we might come to. And Jada then, this, you know, petty criminal with a raft of children around the place, a right boyo, as my mother might have referred to him.
Yeah,
you had to write both of those characters, I'm presuming, John, with respect to both of the characters. You couldn't kind of judge the middle class guy with the lovely attitudes, and you couldn't judge the guy who came up through the system and, you know, behaves badly, is involved in criminal activity and is involved in violence. You couldn't judge either of them for that. You had to find something within both of them that would be appealing.
Well, as a writer, that's the kind of job you hope. I mean, I came from a sort of very working class background in Ayrshire, and I grew up there in the 70s and 80s. It was quite a rough time and place. And I grew up surrounded by Jadas, but I now live a life where I'm kind of more surrounded by Dans, you could say. So I kind of, I felt I was kind of well placed to write both of them convincingly, and to have them not be cliches, you know. So Dan kind of, and by the end of the book, they've both kind of radically changed where they were at the start of the book, you know.
Well,
Dan ends up almost being the criminal by default.
Yeah, we can't get into the whys and wherefores of that, because
no.
Like a good, there's lots of twists and turns, like a good Dickens novel. There's lots of kind of side characters who come in to the plot as well. But it did strike me, in some ways, you know, Jada and Dan one thing that they do have in common is that they don't really have any male pal that they can go and have a chat with, or that they feel they can open up about their personal difficulties, their emotional difficulties. They have nobody who is that person for them. Their partners are different.
They both have groups of friends, but they don't, because I think that, I mean, the first part of the book, there's a lot of talk of Dan's struggles with IVF, and Javi's got a son who's in prison and who he knows he's sort of failed. But they can't talk about this. Dan and Javi, like many men, lack the language to talk about it. And I think this is something, things like IVF, women are much better at talking to their friends about it than men are. And part of the, I was hoping in the novel, it kind of to say, well, you know, there is a way men can hopefully talk to each other about these things, you know?
Yeah, because he has a group of, and again, very successful men. They're all out celebrating the birth of his baby, which comes at the very beginning of the novel. So I'm not giving anything away there. And Jada has a bundle of compatriots in the pub, but you get the sense that, you know, if they can make a buck out of him, they will do that as quickly as he will out of them.
It's very unlikely that Jada would bring up his sort of, you know, emotional problems in the company he keeps.
Yeah,
we sense that wouldn't fly.
But you as the writer can actually show us those emotional problems, which is the joy of reading about Jada, because you maybe see a side of things that I never thought of it way.
There's a few moments along the way. There's a moment where you see Jada with his baby son in the bedroom, and you realise he loves the boy in a way. He's not very good at expressing it, but he does in a way that his own father never expressed any affection towards him. And just those, I think what was going on there, we'd had our fourth and final child around the time I was starting the novel. Mortimer was born, and I knew it was the last time that I was going to do that thing of bringing up a tiny baby, and something within me wanted to commemorate it in literature. Because I think women, you people like Rachel Cusk that write very movingly and perceptively about motherhood, there's not so many men doing it in that space writing about fatherhood, which I thought was interesting. You know, it seemed to me there was a sort of a gap to be filled there.
Yeah, one thing, that there was one section of the novel that did strike me in particular, which is, you know, Dan, who should have who knows how he should behave. Boy, when he gets going on pronouns and LGBTQ, the rights of those people, and trans people, when he gets going on those pronouns, he's certainly not behaving the way he, in inverted commas, should behave.
Well, this is this sort of, that moment you're talking about, it's a sort of private thoughts, if you will.
Yeah, he wouldn't say that out loud to anybody else, I don't think.
And a couple of drinks inside him, you know, and he's still, the funny thing about living in the West End of Glasgow, if you've been there as a student, is you notice the incredible changes that have taken place, you know, as are bound to happen over a 30-year period. So Dan's sort of, ruminating on that.
Yeah, and it is. I mean, there's humour in it, but there's a kind of a nastiness within it as well, which is quite interesting to see it coming from the good guy, or the fellow we think might be the good guy. Listen, John, thanks so much for speaking to us this evening, and congratulations on the novel.
Thank you very much.
That's John Niven, and John's new novel is called The Fathers. It's published by Canongate, and that is our lot for this Wednesday evening.